You should have your Bibles open to Genesis chapter 8, and we're going to get right in this session to looking at the second major section that is the second of four that we find in Genesis 8:15 through 9:17 that points out these adjustments that God made to mankind that gives him a general sense of justice that's heightened from what it was prior to the flood, and that we kind of get down to the roots of all of that to build once again our godly justice on as we receive it in our instruction of justice as sons. So let's begin. The second, third, and fourth of these sections really is where you start seeing these differences and changes. So let's just read this once again. It's the shortest of the passages. It says in verse 20, "And Noah built an altar unto the Lord, and took of every clean beast and of every clean fowl, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled a sweet savor." By the way, this kind of sets the precedent for this, but in all of the sweet savor offerings, this is a terrible, probably a horrible way to express this, but whenever you find the sweet savor offering and offered up to God and he accepts it, it always puts him in a good mood. And really, like I say, that's might not be the best way to say it, but it gets the point across. And it really got him in a good mood. And so the Lord smelled the sweet savor, and the Lord said in his heart, "I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite any more every living thing as I have done. While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease." Now that little section of three verses really points up a dramatic change and difference between the old world order and this new world order, and especially goes to what he is now doing in mankind himself. Noah builds this altar, and the verse I'm really going to go after is verse 22. But it's interesting that Noah builds this altar and offers every clean beast, every clean fowl, as a burnt offering to the Lord, which he understood as Jehovah. And if you have read earlier and have paid attention, you realize that wasn't Noah's idea. That was God's idea. And God made provision for all of that. Before the flood took place and before Noah got the ark completely built, all this, and got it shut in there and everything, God himself made this provision for these animals to be brought on the ark. And he did that before the flood, so Noah knew as he was bouncing around in the water for 40 days and nights and was caring for these animals, and his sons and wives, their wives were caring for these animals, that there weren't just two by two of every kind, but there were also these other animals that were brought on board, and these were particular animals were, as he talks about here, clean. They were specifically for a burnt offering. And notice that you've got the issue, I think it's fascinating, you've got the issue of an altar, you've got the issue of a clean animal versus an unclean one. What could that mean? It's what? Oh, there's a difference for sure. What would the clean animal, at least in one respect, what would it be in God's sight? It would be right, without spot, without blemish. These are, but again, this is all before the law. But this was something that God was doing before the nation of Israel was ever born, before Abraham ever came along. You've got burnt offerings, not just one, but it's plural. Notice, burnt offerings. There's a whole bunch of them that Noah offers. And these clean animals, and the sweet savor, I call it the sweet savor offering. That was something God instituted before a nation of Israel was ever in existence, before even the use of the word Gentiles was ever used in the peoples that went to the Isles of the Gentiles later on there. But before that, God has the concept of the altar, the concept of the clean animals, of burnt offering, and that sweet savor offering. And I think there's real understanding that comes from that, and appreciation for what that's all about. The burnt offering, even when you go down and you see God do this, He'll take concepts that He had in mind and He may even have talked about earlier, but then He'll incorporate some of those things into the law. And oftentimes, they are justice type issues. But one of the things I find fascinating is that when you do go to further explanations and understandings as you go on through God's Word and you get into the law, when these things do become incorporated into the law, you realize that a burnt offering was always something that brought great joy and delight to the Lord. He always, you know, He must really like barbecue. I don't know, but he loves and was delighted in the burnt offering. And I shouldn't have said that because it sounds like I'm making light of a very serious issue. And it is a serious issue. But it's an issue that He gained great joy from and great delight from. And I know that people will take things like this and they'll twist them. They'll say, well, if God is a God that likes burnt up animals, I don't want anything to do with Him. And of course, these are idiots because they have no understanding, first of all, of how they stand in God's sight. I'd always like to say, well, it's better the animal than you, right? Better the animal burn than you burn. I'm just saying. I hate that expression. I'm just saying. But when a burnt offering was made, first of all, I always cue in on the fact that this was, if it was acceptable or a sweet savor offering, God was delighted. His heart was joyful. And in the burnt offering, when you took the animal and you put the animal on that altar, even in any kind of preparation before that, the whole animal was to go on there. At times it'll talk about the animal and its fat and its and all these, it all went on there. The whole animal was burnt. When you offered a sweet savor burnt offering to God, everything was burnt on the altar. God got everything. Man got nothing. Are you getting the point? Why? Why does God get it all? Man gets nothing. Got any ideas? He does all the work. Absolutely. You do none. You're going to get all the benefit from that pleasure that God is in. And every time there is a sweet savor sacrifice that God accepts and His delight, that delight comes out, there's always going to be provision made. And by the way, that even parallels Philippians 4. When the sweet savor sacrifice was made, a provision was made by God. You can go back there and find it sometime on your own. But God gets everything. Man gets nothing because man does not and man cannot provide anything that can justify or sanctify himself. It was a picture of grace. Man receives the benefit. It was a marvelous depiction of the kind of sacrifice that would take place way on down in history when Jesus Christ would come to the cross. God's own Son would be given up as a sweet-smelling sacrifice. He would be the ultimate fulfillment of every one of those offerings. He would be the one who would be the clean lamb of God. He would be the one who was without spot and blemish. He would be the one that would die. He would be the one that would give by his sacrifice his Father the greatest joy and pleasure and delight, because his sacrifice, unlike the animals, would be the one that would take away the sins of the world, not simply cover them over. And so this is where this was where the provision for our sin debt was paid. And then the joy and the delight of God over that. And there was great joy. That's why, folks, that's not just blithering, flowery language in the book of Hebrews that talks about even with the Son himself, for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. He had a real sense of what a sweet-smelling savor sacrifice offering does to his Father. And he enjoyed it too and delighted in that. But what's interesting here, and again, there's some fascinating things you can go into here, but this is the first sweet savor offering or offerings, burnt offerings, in the Word of God. This is the very first time it occurs. And so even though all of mankind at the flood gets destroyed and reduced down to just 8 persons, all right? So in a sense, God doesn't have to, you know, try to get this across to 1 million people, but just 8. Since those 8 persons are still, though, naturally sons of Adam, Noah, even though he's going to receive that change, his sons and their children will receive this alteration God makes in their sense of justice. This is why I went and harped on this, I guess it was last Sunday morning, that God doesn't make man better here. That's why you have, sitting in verse 21, you have the Lord saying that the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. That's not the same thing that was said back in chapter 6 when man was worthy for the flood to come upon the earth and destroy him from off the face of it. It sounds very similar, but pay very close attention to the exact words God uses. What God says now in his joy, in his delight, in his good mood, is to state that he hasn't made man naturally better. That Noah stands there, his sons stand there, their wives all stand there, and by virtue, the whole human race stands there in that condensed form. And God is able to make it clear to them by this sacrifice, these sacrifices, the sweet-smelling sacrifices, the burnt offerings, that those 8 persons still by nature are naturally sons of Adam. And their sons are going to be sons of Adam. As they procreate, as they have children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and the world starts to have the mass of humanity spread over it, God makes it very clear to Noah, and it's to be perpetuated through the teaching that they're going to be giving to their descendants. And he makes it clear both by burnt offerings and what he records and says about man in verse 21, that God has not changed or altered man's sinful nature. It's very important God got that across, that even though I'm starting a new world order, you're still by nature a son of Adam. You still need regeneration. You still need justification and sanctification. And you still need God to provide it. And so God comes along and makes sure that they're clear that he hasn't altered man's sinful nature. He hasn't made man better, and so God comes along and reestablishes the fact that, look, what he depicts on that altar with those animals being put on there, God is basically saying to Noah and to his sons and their wives and their descendants, Genesis 3:15 is still marching on. And whatever man did to try to screw it up, and whatever the adversary did in cooperation, or I should reverse that, man in cooperation with the adversary, Genesis 3:15 is still marching on. I'd like to have seen what the adversary did when he saw that. Genesis 3:15 is going to march right onto that cross, flood or no flood. old or new world order, it's still going to that cross. And a new world order still has that issue in it and to it. And by the way, the sweet savor sacrifice is, like I say, is one that we find even in our epistle, and it's really wonderful to go there and spend some time with that over in Philippians 4, if you would, and just have some fun with it. But notice something else. I want to get through this one tonight. Notice verses 21 and 22, especially. When God begins to say something here, the Lord had smelled the sweet savor, then he says something. But notice this. Look at verse 21. And the Lord smelled a sweet savor, and you'll read right over this if you're not careful and not paying any attention to it, thinking that God's just talking to Noah. But it says, and the Lord said in his heart. God didn't say this out loud. He said this to himself. He said it in his heart. But he determined to have it recorded in his word, so we know exactly what he said in his heart. I just think that's fascinating to see little things like that, that he could have very well never have recorded that. We wouldn't have known he even thought it. But he recorded his thoughts. Didn't just record his words, he recorded his thoughts. Now, verse 22, I want to end tonight talking a little bit about verse 22, because this is where one of those big changes is seen. God says at the end of verse 21 that he's not going to again curse the ground anymore for man's sake. Then he talks about that man is still evil by nature. He's still evil from his youth. And he says in his heart that he will neither again smite any more everything living as I have done. But verse 22, while the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. That is one of the most important verses in this whole thing. Now, I'm going to warn you about something before I make some comments on this. You probably will never encounter this, but I seem to attract this thing like a lightning rod. Bible scoffers will come along and they will try and challenge this verse. And they'll bring up passages a lot like what Sheila and I were talking about at the break over there in Peter, in 2 Peter. But they'll bring up other passages. Okay, let's look at this one. Let's not look at it. I don't have time to look at it. I'm just going to talk about it. You remember Joshua, right? What people do is they come along, they look at verse 22 and they say, okay, God promised here, and he's going to set it in the form of a covenant with the earth, that all of these issues of environmental issues like seed time and harvest, so we're talking about time. We're talking about the time of springtime, summertime, autumn, winter, those times of the year. He even talks about day and night shall not cease. So supposedly the earth is going to be revolving around, and we're going to have 24 hours a day, and it's going to be that way from now on, and we're going to have spring, summer, winter, and spring, summer, fall, and winter. That's not going to go away, and the crops are going to grow, and it's going to be day and night. We're going to have 24 hours in a day from now on. Well, if you handle that verse that way, you're going to paint yourself into a corner and somebody's going to call you on it. And they're going to take you to Joshua for at one place. There's another place you could go to, several other places. There's one in Daniel that comes to mind. There's another one in, I won't even say, but I know there's another one. And they're going to say, well, what about Joshua's long day? That was more than 24 hours in one day. And they're going to come along and they're going to find verses where you're going to find God talking about altering time. Read verse 22 again. Is there anything in that verse that says God can't lengthen a day? It was still one day. In fact, God can and will alter time from time to time. But that's one example of it. But he does not violate in any way Genesis 8:22. The problem is, you read Genesis 8:22 real fast and you think you've got it when you're not paying attention to the exact words God uses. God's a stickler about words. And he was very careful. I just want to kind of put that caveat in there, because there's passages where he'll talk, Daniel will talk about some things about God dealing and kind of altering time. Well, he can certainly do it. And he can do it while at the exact same time the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. And even in Joshua's long day, it was one day, and there was a day and there was a night, and day and night did not cease. So, just again, something that you probably weren't even thinking about, but just to throw it out there, so that all you got to do when you get in a situation like that, 99% of the time when somebody tries to challenge something, they're not sticking with exactly what God said. Well, verse 22 comes along and acts as a kind of an addendum to what God says in his heart in verse 21. But what he says in verse 22 is now part of, especially part of, I'll just put it up here like this, verse 22, this new world order. And it's now going to be integrated into this new, in other words, what he says here is going to be part of the new world order standard operating procedure from now on. And it is from that time of Genesis chapter 8 here all the way through, it's going to be that. If that's going to be in vogue, and that means even today in this dispensation of grace, it's still in effect. And so this is part of the standard operating procedure of the new world order from now on. And even though what he says in verse 22 is a part of the environment, and it is. And by the way, this is where your skin shouldn't crawl, because we talk about the environment. God talks about the environment. And even though what he says in verse 22, that is a part of our environment. While the earth remains, all you got to do is look around and say, it's still here. So while, and I know it's hard to believe going what we went through in just the last week, but believe me when I tell you, it's been about that hot before. So the fact of the matter is, I can guarantee there may not be anything in some places in this country to harvest, but harvest is coming. And this will all break. And come October, we're going to flip a switch in our house that goes from cool to heat. And we'll do that every fall. And you can count on it. And nothing man could do, I mean that, nothing man could do could ever change that. That's going to happen. And it's now part of the new world order. And it's the environmental cycles of the earth is actually an integral part of the new world order in a way that you may have never thought of. The obvious issue here that is, as long as this new world order is in effect, Genesis 8:22 is going to be part of it. That means, just by the way of a nice little commercial, God has made these adjustments to the new world order that from now on, I don't care how advanced we get. I don't care who Albert Einstein was. Albert Einstein was wrong. By comparison, to lay Albert Einstein next to God's word, Albert Einstein was a blithering nut who knew nothing. And I could say the same for Hawking and for a lot of the others, because they don't pay attention to what God says. And God's going to take these wise fools in their own foolishness. But from now on, no matter what we do or think we can do, is going to alter or change Genesis 8:22. And therefore, these adjustments are made so that this new world order, and they're not only made to the new world and its order, but they're actually adjustments made to man himself that makes it so that neither man himself, nor the earth itself, nor this world system will, listen, ever be destroyed by man. Man will not do it, even if he could, and man cannot do it. It can't be done. What God did here forbids it. That means in 1962 or 63, when that little ball cap wearing guy down there in Cuba, you know, we got to the Cuban Missile Crisis, and everybody was just, we're this close to self-destruction, and Hollywood went nuts with all kinds of movies about it. We were never this close. We weren't even close. By the way, this is one of the reasons why the Cold War was cold and never got hot. Does that ever dawn on anybody? The Cold War never became hot? What do you think that was? I'm not saying God miraculously intervened. He didn't have to. God sat back in his easy chair, put his hands behind his head, and said, "Watch what I did at the flood. These birds will never do it." Why? Because they have too much of a sense of justice. They're not going to do that. The destruction of this earth is going to be for my son when he judges it. Anyway, this is some fascinating stuff. But the genius of God, the real genius, in making this statement in verse 22, and here's where you may not have put some things together, and this will be kind of fun. Making this provision, which is what comes out of us, you know it's coming. When he's in a good mood and he's got that sweet-smelling savor, he's going to get ready to, he's going to say something and he's going to provide something. And the provision he makes here is fantastic. It's for the new world order that he established post-flood. And that provision is that by establishing the environmental issues that he does, the specific ones that he does, it's mentioned there, seed time and harvest, and all of us have to, if we don't have that, we don't live. By the way, I don't know if you know this or not, I'm just going to throw this out, but I think one of the most fantastic and most overlooked issues, and I'm guilty, so I'm saying this to myself, issues of survival, is that I believe God designed us all, I mean as families, to have a garden. If you've got a garden, your family's going to eat. One of the big problems we've gotten ourselves into is that we've relied on Kroger's to be our garden instead of our backyard. Well, Kroger's ain't always going to be there, but I guarantee you, seed time and harvest will be there. Cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. Now, when God made that provision and established the environmental issues he did in verse 22, you may not realize it, but all of that has a huge effect upon man. It has a huge effect upon man's just dealings with others. It has a huge effect on his just dealings with established authority. Think about it. If you've got seasonal changes that's going to take place, there's branching out ramifications that come from that as to how I live in summer and winter. I'm going to have certain needs. I'm going to have to do certain things. That's going to start generating what? Business to meet those needs. It's going to, all kinds of things start coming out of this. Government issues start coming out of it. Heavens, even to this day, we have one of the big things our government is involved in is, isn't it, trying to find sources of electricity and power so that we can have what? Heat in the winter and cool in the summer? Hello, Genesis 8:22. It shows its head right there in the middle of town hall, and people don't even know it's there. These have huge effects, even as and especially as man multiplies upon the face of the earth and ends up spreading abroad across the earth. It makes it so man is going to have to deal with these geographical and environmental natures of laws of nature. And really, that's not a bad expression if you use it biblically. These are, God is establishing the laws that nature is going to follow. They're His laws, but nature's going to follow these changes. We're going to have springtime, summer, fall, winter. We're going to go through seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. And God is therefore going, listen, if that's a provision, if I provide you with something, what is my expectation? Is what? You get something in return. But I have an expectation. If you're a parent or you've ever been a child, which I think hits everybody here, if your parent gave you something, let's say, God forbid, they actually gave you the credit card for the night, what did you immediately become when you took it? Okay, responsible, we're getting there, that's close. You're right on the 9 ring. One more little adjustment and you'll be in the 10 ring. You become responsible, but what when you come home and your father says, "Now, give me the credit card and tell me what you spent." Now what are you? What? Accountable. That's exactly what God did here. The moment God did this and made this provision, it made it so that as man multiplies upon the earth and is going to have to deal with these provisions God made geographically and environmentally, these changes to nature, God is going to expect now man to cope with seed time and harvest, summer and winter, day and night. He's going to cope with these environmental changes. And based upon coping with them, God is going to implement some things that regardless where man is in this world, he could be where he is on the face of this earth. Man, because of this, is from here on going to be accountable to God. Because God made those changes. God gave man that. God made those environmental changes so that seed time, harvest, cold, heat, summer, and winter, day and night shall not cease. And you live in that world. And I don't care who you are. And I don't care where you are. You live in that world. And because, by virtue of simply living in a provision God made, you are accountable to Him that made it. In fact, if you haven't made these connections yet, that's why Paul makes reference to this when he deals with the issue of man's accountability in the light of God consciousness in Romans chapter 1. When he can talk about man being accountable to know God because something has been revealed to him, well, this is one of the seed beds where that comes from. The accountability factor is because of what God changed in man right after the flood took place. He's accountable to God. It doesn't make any difference where he is on the face of this earth. There's some things that God did in preparation for spreading man abroad. He was thinking of all of this back here so that when man would spread abroad, regardless of where he ended up, he could be on the North Pole. Or the South Pole, or he could live right dead on the equator. He could be the farthest distance possible from the original Eden. No matter where he is on this earth, no one, in a cave, in a loincloth, in a city, no one, nowhere, at no time is going to be at a disadvantage to know God and to be conscious of God's existence. I don't care what the atheists say. All they're doing is holding the truth in unrighteousness. By the way, you don't get all that I just said from verse 22. Actually, you get a lot of that as it gets added to later on. But that's where it all got started. The truth is, God made it so that he can hold men accountable even if they're out in the, what he'll call in a couple of chapters, in the isles of the heathen, the isles of the Gentiles. And he can hold them accountable. And the reason why he can hold them accountable is because of Genesis 8:22 and some other things that he says between it and the end of Genesis 11. But God's able to say and do to those people what he says and does, because when he established the new world order, he established the laws of nature for this new world order and made it so that regardless of where man is on this earth, there are some fundamental things that would not cease while the earth remains. And those changes are changes that can cause the heart of a man to recognize there has to be a God behind this. It's fascinating to read some of the accounts of, like, the Incas, who just before they got wiped out, I don't know, as Cortez or somebody went down there and wiped them all out, but there was one of their main priests, I can't remember the guy's name now, who recognized, they worship the sun, of course. But then he recognized, he watched a little puffy cloud, cute little cloud, kind of looked like a baby or a bunny. And it just went woof, 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 right in front of the sun, and it blocked the sun out. Well, if the sun is God, how could a little puffy cloud block it out, block him out? Or my hand? And it's recorded. I can't remember. I used to have this stuff written down. But I can remember the recording of how it was a perfect description of God consciousness. And it's going by these same kind of things that got germinated back here in Genesis 8:22. Well, in view of that, wherever man is on the face of this earth, he's accountable for these fundamental things. And he's accountable to God, because God was the one responsible for those provisions. And if you're dealing with being held, listen, if you're dealing with being held accountable, when you're dealing with accounting type things, you're dealing with being held to answer for your responsibilities and your conduct. And if you're being held to answer for your responsibilities and your conduct, folks, that then demands you have a sense of justice. When you turn in your credit card back to your dad after the night's fun, you go through an accounting. That's a judicial, legal, law type, just type term. And you're being held accountable for your responsibilities and for your conduct with it. And anytime you're going to be held to answer for responsibility and conduct, it would be, how could you do that with a child whose sense of justice isn't nearly what an adult's is? It demands a sense of justice. But one of the important and critical things you need to appreciate is that verse 22, if nothing else, establishes order. And that's where I really nail down that expression, the new world order. When I talk about the new world order, the order. Peter calls the world before the flood the old world, so you can just kind of turn that over and say, it's safe to say that you've got post-flood a new world. But Genesis 8:22, I know it starts a little earlier than that, but this really nails it down, that you have a deliberate, ordered system God ordered it in a particular way, at least geographically and environmentally, but there's more to the order than that, and that's coming up in the next two sections in chapter 9, but we're out of time for tonight. So we'll stop right there, and that ties off nicely the second major section. But hopefully the things I've said make you realize that, wow, there's some really simple terminology there, but if I get it in my head, if I get that idea that all of these are seed beds that generate as man spreads across the earth, you'll start seeing marvelous ramifications of all of this. And these differences really start coming out more boldly than ever before. Well, we'll just briefly touch on the next two on Sunday, and that should be all the background work that's going to be necessary before we delve into the actual details of the verses coming up in Romans chapter 12. So we'll stop right there for tonight, and we'll pick this up on Sunday, continuing to deal with the great differences between the old world order and the new world order at the flood of Noah, with our heads bowed.